Good evening and welcome behind the news for September 7, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two topics up tonight, although several more guests than that to address them. In about 5 minutes, we'll listen to David Dunbar, who is executive editor of Popular Mechanics and a co-author of Debunking 9/11 Myths, Why Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to the Facts. This is a book-length version of an investigation that Popular Mechanics magazine did, about a year or so ago. Dunbar, executive editor, who led the editorial team that first investigated the conspiracy theories and supervises the magazine's coverage of aviation, military technology, disaster response, and other topics. And after that interview, I'll just have about a minute and a half excerpt from the British parliamentarian George Galloway commenting on the psychology, the colonial psychology behind 9/11 conspiracy thinking. And then about, a little after 20 minutes after the hour, we'll talk with Sylvia Allegretto, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute, one of the co-authors of their biannual volume, The State of Working America, preliminary version released on Labor Day in even-numbered years, and then a fuller version will be released in book form on January 1st, I believe, or early January of 2007. What's going on with income, poverty, wages, all that sort of thing. And then about 5:45 or so, we'll speak with Mark Levitan, who has been doing that sort of analysis of the latest income and poverty statistics for New York City. And Mark Levitan, an economist at the Community Service Society and the master of social statistics in New York City. Just a few words about the economic headlines, since time is a little short today. This morning, the Labor Department reporting first-time claims for unemployment insurance down 9,000 last week. It's been kind of flat now for the last month or so at a decent but not great level, which is what's been characterizing the job market for the last couple of years. Showing a job market that is expanding slowly, not at the boom rates that we saw in the late 1990s. Earlier this week, speaking of booms, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting revised estimates of productivity gains in the first quarter of this year and the substantially revised estimates of unit labor costs. Unit labor costs are a statistical way of representing how much employers have to pay to produce a unit of output. Now, that is a very complicated concept to turn into actual numbers, but conceptually it's just how much it costs to produce stuff from an employer's point of view, how much they have to pay workers. It is a very reliable leading indicator of what's happening with inflation in the near future. That really, really shot up because the Labor Department got revised estimates of wage and salary income in the first quarter of this year from their colleagues over at the Bureau of Economic Analysis. You may have read some newspaper stories about this. There's a great deal of excitement over this in the financial markets, and a great deal of worry about inflationary spike, and this was going to turn the Federal Reserve very hostile, urging them to push up interest rates. There should be a very substantial footnote or caveat attached to these numbers, which was largely missing in the news reports. The revised estimates of wage and salary income for the first quarter and to a lesser degree for the second are almost entirely the result, according to or as far as we can tell so far, according to people at the Bureau of Economic Analysis that I spoke with last week, the result of bonus and options income for upper-income workers. This has nothing to do with a wage boom for the average worker because that wage boom just isn't happening for the average worker, as we'll hear from Sylvia Allegretto a little later on. So very misplaced anxieties in the financial markets. And some sign of improved confidence among consumers last week with the ABC News Washington Post a weekly measure of consumer confidence, picking up 4 points, largely reversing its loss the previous week. So perhaps that measure is stabilizing, but it is still at a rather low level for 5 years into an economic expansion. So I don't really have time to say much more, so let's take – what did I plan to do here? I've lost track of my schedule. Here it is. I think I'll just introduce this rather than let's just play the music. Yeah, okay, track. Don't drink that coke. It's really bad for you. And that bit of the Mekon song, Insignificance, which I often play when conspiracy-related material comes up. This being the run-up to the anniversary of 9/11, there's a book just out from the Popular Mechanics editorial team, lead author David Dunbar, who we'll hear from in a moment, on refuting all the popular 9/11 conspiracies. I feel rather strongly about this. I'm a little embarrassed that this radio station traffics in this stuff so heavily and raises money off it. Conspiracy theories have historically been the province of the far right, the paranoid right in the United States. It's infected our side of the political spectrum in recent years to very unfortunate effect. It curiously is usually a symptom of marginality and powerlessness, so I guess that's only appropriate the more marginal and powerless we get, but it's a very sad way to look at the world. So let's listen to this unfortunately brief interview, that's all I was allowed time, with David Duncan, who is the executive editor of Popular Mechanics, co-author of the book Debunking 9/11 Myths, just out from Hearst Books. David Duncan.
First of all, let's just deal with a couple of the myths one by one. One of the most popular being that jet fuel just doesn't burn at a high enough temperature to bring down a building the way the World Trade Center collapsed. What do you say to that?
The usual conspiracy theory is that the fires in the World Trade Center weren't hot melt steel. So how could the buildings collapse? And then that usually leads to a controlled demolition theory. But in fact, no one has ever stated that the temperature of the fires were hot enough to melt steel or needed to be hot enough to melt steel, that they were at a temperature that robbed the structural steel of a significant amount of its strength and integrity. And that, combined with the damage done by the impact of the airplanes, was enough to bring down the towers.
People have said that the Empire State Building could take a plane, but the World Trade Center couldn't. Therefore, that proves it was an inside job. What do you say?
The two structures are vastly different. The Empire State Building is a sort of classic steel frame building with a masonry facade, and it weighs about 38 pounds per cubic foot. The World Trade Center has represented a marked departure in design and weighed about 8 or 9 pounds a cubic foot. They were mostly air. The plane was also, it was a B-25 bomber, I believe, that struck the Empire State Building back in 45, and it was much smaller, flying much more slowly, and contained much less fuel than the jets that struck the World Trade Center. But it was primarily the vast difference in the two structures' construction that make it a poor comparison of why the Empire State Building is still standing and why the towers are not.
What would have it involved with outfitting the World Trade Center with explosives to bring it down the way the conspiracy theorists said? Is that a simple task?
We asked one of the leading controlled demolition experts about that, and he said that there were not charges available that were large enough to bring down the towers. And we asked him, we pressed him on it, well, say, hypothetically, what would it take? And he said if such charges existed, it would take a team of 75 workers per tower with unlimited access to three floors for about 2 months to strip insulation and lay charges and wire them up. But he was adamant in saying that there is nothing that he saw in any of the evidence that suggested such a thing had occurred. But with the amount of traffic in the World Trade Centers on an average day, I mean, it's preposterous to think that 150 men and women could be wiring the buildings for destruction and escape notice.
And what about World Trade Center 7? That's also a popular object of speculation. It's allegedly came down in a completely implausible way. What do you say?
Well, the World Trade Center 7 is a completely different kind of structure from the two Trade Center towers. Twin Towers. It was an unusual structure in itself, though, because it was built over a Con Ed substation, and it had a number of very broad floor areas that were supported by lateral columns. I think they're about 2,000 square feet. But the salient point, I think, is that initially the FEMA report that came out in May 2002, and just by the video and photographs on the day, didn't reveal the kind of heavy damage that was done on the south face of the building by the collapse of the Twin Towers, well, principally World Trade Center 1. And there's a photograph that's online, actually, that's taken from a New York City police helicopter that shows the south face of World Trade Center 7, and it's massively damaged by the falling debris, and about 25% of that south face was scooped out. And so the structural damage there, and the fires that burned for a long time, I know a lot of the conspiracy theorists say that there were small fires, which is not true. The fires burned there unattended for about 7 hours, and the combination, again, of the debris damage and the fires conspired to bring down the building.
Now let's move down to Washington, and of course the story about the Pentagon, the hole in the building just isn't consistent with being hit by a big jet. What do you say?
Well, there were two holes in the Pentagon that have received the attention, and the hole in the facade was about 90 feet wide, and people say, well, the wingspan of a 757 is 125 feet or so, and how come the hole is smaller than the span of the plane? But this is based on the assumption that a plane traveling at that speed hitting a reinforced concrete building is going to punch a cartoon-like outline of itself in the building, which is just not the case. And in addition to that, there is a lot of evidence that the wings were shearing off before the fuselage struck the facade, so that the hole in the facade of the building was punched by the fuselage, and a lot of eyewitnesses reported that it flowed into the building almost in a liquid form. And then the second hole, the smaller hole, which is about 15 feet in diameter, was punched through the C-ring by part of the landing gear, which was one of the denser, heavier components of the airplane and traveled farthest after the impact. But the important thing to remember is that there is a lot of wreckage that was found, and in fact there's a photograph of some of the wreckage on the Pentagon lawn that's in the book. The black box is found, the landing gear, the shredded aluminum. Forensics were done on the site, and all but one of the passengers was positively identified. There's a mountain of evidence that a 757 struck the Pentagon. I've seen no evidence in the research that we've done here that indicate any presence of a missile, which is usually cited as the conspiracy theorist's assumption of what struck the Pentagon. So there's no evidence of that.
And speaking of missiles, it's also a popular theory that a missile took down the plane, was it Flight 93, over Pennsylvania. What do you say about that?
Well, in fact, one of the conspiracy theorists claimed to know the identity of the pilot that fired two Sidewinders that brought down Flight 93, and so we tracked down this pilot, and it turned out he was 1,100 miles northwest of southwestern Pennsylvania where Flight 93 crashed, and we talked to someone that he flew back to Albany to head up the emergency response effort in New York State. So his presence on that day is well established. And the conspiracy theory about a missile bringing down Flight 93 is predicated on erroneous early reports that there was quite a wide debris field for Flight 93. And there were early reports of human remains being found in a lake near the crash site, Indian Lake. And there were early reports that in some circles that part of the engine had was found miles from the crash site. All of that on later reporting has been decisively refuted. There were no remains found in Indian Lake, and the remains and the wreckage was confined, or the remains rather, were found in a 70-acre site around the crater. And the engine part actually was found about 300 yards, I believe it was, downhill from the impact site.
The big question hanging over is, these guys just weren't good enough pilots to pull off a stunt like this.
Right, we've seen that quite a bit as well. But by the end of 2000, all four of the hijacker pilots had logged 250 hours of flight time and were FAA-certified commercial pilots. And we talked to a number of flight instructors, and they said, well, you know, is it possible for them to pull this off? And one thing to remember is that they didn't have to do the three toughest things in flying, which is take off, land, or fly in bad weather. We all remember what the weather was like on that beautiful fall day. And that they were good enough. They weren't great pilots, and you can see that in transcripts of the calls that were made from some of the hijacked planes, that the flying was erratic, but they were good enough to do the job. And the flight instructors that we talked to found that that was credible.
Polls show that about a third of Americans believe some sort of inside job or complicity by the government was involved in 9/11. Do you find any holes in the official story to start with, and why do you think that these beliefs are so widespread?
The 9/11 Commission, which a lot of conspiracy theorists think is just sort of a lapdog and didn't press hard for information, actually did press hard on a number of fronts where they found there was less cooperation that they wanted, especially from the FAA and NORAD. And the two co-chairs, Lee Hamilton and Thomas Kane, make that point in a book that they've just published called Without Precedent, which is the inside story of the 9/11 Commission. It's quite clear that they pressed very hard against what they felt were stonewalling agencies to get information, and that NORAD in particular was reluctant to clarify some errors in their timeline. And these kinds of things helped to feed into a number of conspiracy theorists. Things didn't quite add up. Well, it was true they didn't add up, but the 9/11 Commission went to a lot of trouble to establish a timeline based on the evidence that would account for the actions of the FAA and NORAD. So there were confusion. There were questions that were not answered fully, or contradictory information provided by some agencies, and I think that helped to fuel it. But I think there is an element of the conspiracy theory crowd that hates this particular administration, and others seem to hate the U.S. government in general, regardless of what administration is in power. And some, I think, seem to want a grander explanation for events of this magnitude, and they don't find the mainstream explanation somehow grandiose enough to account for such a traumatic event. And that's fairly consistent with other traumatic events in American history, Pearl Harbor and so on.
Does any of that stonewalling by NORAD or the FAA make you suspicious, or are they just covering their butts?
It looks to me like, from what I've read, from listening to some of the tapes online of the actual NORAD and FAA interaction, it seems to me like kind of bureaucratic stonewalling. I think one thing that Lee Hamilton and Thomas Kane make clear is that the military has never admitted that the four jets that were scrambled were in reality chasing a phantom plane, i.e. Flight 11, which had already crashed into the World Trade Center. But because of confusion and miscommunication, they were still looking for it. And I guess I'm making an assumption here that it makes them look bad. Now, that kind of behavior on a part of an agency is that's bad. But to make a leap from that to saying that there was either a shadowy group within the government or the government itself planning the events of 9/11 is a huge and unsubstantiated leap.
And that the voice of David Dunbar, executive editor of Popular Mechanics and co-editor of volume Debunking 9/11 Myths, Why Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to the Facts. It does a point-by-point reputation of the most popular of those points circulating on the Internet in the minds of the so-called 9/11 truth movement. And I just don't quite understand why supposed political radicals would want to deny the agency and anger of a bunch of people who are really annoyed at U.S. imperial policy in the Middle East. Why is it such a stretch to believe that they would do something to fight back? I think it was criminal and stupid and counterproductive act, but it nonetheless was an attempt to say something to the United States. And why deny that agency? And along those lines, let's listen to this excerpt from an interview I did about a year ago with the British Member of Parliament, George Galloway, who represents a district full of Muslims in London. George Galloway. The attitude that Saddam displayed, the Anglophilia you describe, in Iraq and also elsewhere in the Arab world, is this some sort of psychopathology, a post-colonial psychopathology, or is there something else to it? What do you make of it?
It's partly clutching at straws. But it is a psychopathology. It is a colonized mind, colonized mentality. It's one of the reasons, for example, as we're having quite a serious conversation, I can go into this. It's one of the reasons why so many Muslims don't believe that Muslims were responsible for 9/11. They spin all these absurd conspiracy theories that, you know, Bush did it, the Zionists did it, they knew it was coming, they arranged it. And
that's popular with some of our loonier people on the left.
Well, it's very popular. It's widely popular in the United States, and it's completely preposterous rubbish. But it's virtually universally the view of Muslims. And one of the reasons why is that they don't believe that Muslims could have carried out such a sophisticated act as 9/11, as successfully as the dastardly murder of 3,000 people was. This is, again, a sign of almost self-hatred, a sense of inferiority, of unworthiness, and the superiority of the foreigner, the Khawaja in Arabic, that somehow the white man is top dog because he is top dog.
And that, the voice of George Galloway, the British Member of Parliament, interview I recorded with him about a year ago, broadcast on this show during a fundraising segment last October. Oh, let's take a little musical break while we try to raise Sylvia Allegretto. And that, the Gang of Four, from the song To Hell with Poverty from quite a while ago, about 20 years ago. And we're having a little in the way of technical difficulties at the moment. And we're back, I should say, since it's just past the half hour. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. And after a little bit of telephonic melodrama and some heroic rescue work by Michael G. Haskins, we now have Sylvia Allegretto on the line, a little belatedly. Welcome to WBAI, Sylvia.
Oh, it's good to be here. I'm sorry, did you have problems reaching me?
There was some miscommunication about the telephone number, but we finally retrieved it.
Oh, excellent, because I was waiting.
Okay, so, yes, I'm sorry to make you wait.
No problem.
Stew in uncertainty.
Glad we've hooked up.
Before I wanted to talk about the state of working America, we get to the state of working America, you did an economic snapshot for the EPI website a day or two ago.
Yes.
About the narrowing of the gender gap.
Right.
And superficially it might look like good news, and I think the Bush administration celebrated it as such, but what's the real story?
Yeah, well, in fact, the gender pay gap is the ratio is the highest on record, or the gap is the lowest on record, however you want to look at it. But yeah, it's not quite the good news that it it sounds like at the onset, because of course we like to have the narrowing of the gender gap, just not in the way that it has actually happened. The gap has narrowed over the past 2 years, but only because over the past 2 years, wages for full-time, full earnings, men and women have both been falling. It's just that they fell more so for men, thereby effectively decreasing the gap itself.
Well, that's not very good news unless you're an employer, I guess. But this has been an employer's economy.
Yeah, and I think this goes into like the larger question of the economy, that when you have, you know, wages falling for you know, folks who are so attached to the labor force. These are, remember, full-time, full-year earners for men and women. You know, they continue to fall. Just not good news.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. And I should say that The State of Working America is a biannual volume that comes out from the Economic Policy Institute. The 2006-2007 is out in advance proofs. News, of course, is circulating as a result of that. And then it will be issued as a book by Cornell University Press early next year. And you are the co-author, along with mm-hmm. Lawrence Michel and Jerry Bernstein, of this really excellent, indispensable, tremendous volume. I'm really impressed. What is this, the 10th
Thank
that
you.
You've done, I think?
This is the 10th edition coming out of EPI, and this is, I've been lucky enough for, personally, this is my second time as being co-author.
Yeah, and it's really, it's one of the few indispensable pieces of economic book publishing, I think, that's around. So let's, we're now, what, 5 years into economic expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Incomes are flat to down, poverty, flat. What's up?
Well, that's about it. I mean, you know, we kind of like to look at things over business cycles. So if you take, you know, again, going from the release of the data on the earnings of men and women that we just kind of looked at, those were new data that were released from the Census Bureau last Tuesday. And so that gives us another full year's look at some data out of the Census Bureau, because these are all data for 2000, annual data for 2005. So now we can look at data over an entire cycle, and using these new data or using an we use a lot of different data sources, but any way you kind of slice and dice it, you get the same picture, and that is that over this cycle from 00, so, you know, you kind of like to say the recession was in 2001. Let's look at the peak year before that, which would be 2000, and see, you know, this far out where we stand, because certainly you like to see as we kind of go into these business cycles that each peak is higher than the last, right?
So, well, 2000 was quite a peak. That was one of the great booms of modern history.
Sure. I mean, we definitely had, we had problems there with the tech bubble bursting. But, around that, the rest of the economy was pretty strong. But even if you looked at a lot of these data from the trough, which would be 2001, we're still lagging way behind. Because the fact is that output over these either 4 or 5 year period is up considerably. From 00 to 05, we're up about 2.5% GDP. We have productivity growth. Again, whether you look at 2 or 4 or 5 years, but I happen to have the numbers in front of me for the 5 years into the cycle, you know, productivity growth has been very stellar over this time for the most part, and is up almost 17%. But then when you look at the median household incomes, especially for workers, working folks, so those headed by people that are less than 65, over the same time frame, they're down 5.4% or about $3,000 for a typical family.
Now, this is the kind of thing you'd expect maybe a year, maybe two after a recession. But starting mm-hmm. in the early 90s, we had this divorce between what's mm-hmm. The economy, you know, that abstraction is doing, and what happens to actual people.
Yeah.
There's a famous quote from a Brazilian politician from the early 60s who said, the economy is doing well, but the people aren't. Has that disease now taken effect in the United States?
I think that's right. I mean, the kind of, you know, what you're kind of tapping into is the idea that, you know, from 40,000 feet, the economy looks pretty good. Again, we've just discussed some of those kind of overall economic indicators that have been fairly strong accompanying this our latest expansion that we're in. And but yet you see a real disconnect between numbers such as productivity and productivity growth and increases in earnings potential of people. We normally think, as economists, we think that, well, you know, increased productivity growth will be transformed into, you know, increased living standards for everyone, for workers, for everyone across the board. But we're certainly not seeing this as this kind of this recovery has, by and large, bypassed middle and low income workers.
Well, what's up? I mean, is something structurally changed in the economy?
Yeah.
That, you know, you see these great productivity numbers. Supposedly, mm-hmm. productivity is a long-term determinant of living standards.
Yes.
But productivity has shot way up for the last 10 years. Wages have mm-hmm. done nothing next to that. What's up?
Yeah. Well, I think if you look at the period you're talking about, and you're absolutely right on, in 1995, if you have to pin it down to a year, we really see productivity taking off. And then again, in about 2000, 2001, we see it accelerating even more. But it's kind of funny because those two periods, even though they both have really good productivity numbers, in 1995 and 2000, we were in a tight labor market situation. And in fact, it was been one of the only periods in recent history where we actually saw wages across the board, even low-income, moderate, and high wages increasing in lockstep with productivity increases. So we think that a part of the puzzle that's sadly missing today is the full employment scenario.
Well, the unemployment rate is pretty low by recent historical standards. So what's up?
Yeah, most people would point to, that's the first place you would go to is let's look at the unemployment rate. But the fact is, if you 2 points on this, the 4.7% unemployment rate that we have now is much, much higher than the actual unemployment rate, for instance. And the annual rate for 2000 was only 4%. And there were some months in 2000 when it was, below 4%. So in the short term, compared to the 1995-2000, and the relative rate is higher now. And also we think that especially through this cycle, that the unemployment rate never has been a very good indication of labor market tightness or slackness, if you will. I mean, you'd think that as the labor force tightens up, or it's reflected in the unemployment rate coming down, and certainly unemployment has come down from the high that it was and that it reached in 2003 following the recession. But when people drop out of the labor force because you had a prolonged period of really weak job growth, I mean, remember, we shed jobs as if we were in recession all the way into mid 2003, and then when we started cranking out jobs, it was at a much slower pace than any other time in history, any other historical job growth following a recession. So people left the labor market in droves, we think. And so employment rates, for instance, are another good indicator to look at with unemployment rates to see if these other major indicators are kind of, if you will, moving in the right direction. And while some of them are coming back, they're still way off of the pace that they were.
Reminder that by definition, you have to be actively looking for work to be counted as unemployed. And if you've just given up, the thing is hopeless, then you're not counted as unemployed.
That's right. So that's a good indication. That's one reason why you can imagine that the unemployment rate could be a little misleading. And we certainly know that was the case when people, employment rates, just took a dive in 2001, 2002, 2003. And they have come back some as the job market has picked up. But like I say, they're still kind of off their pace. And so when you look at, for instance, young college graduates, they certainly, you'd think would be out there really looking for work and have some of the highest employment rates. And they came down, they bottomed out in 2003, started to come back when jobs started to come back, but again, because the job market has been so weak, it has been pretty moderate. And by the way, even last month's job number of 128,000 is very moderate for this time in this far into a recovery.
Yes, it's like a half to a third of what we'd see in a robust expansion.
Exactly. So even though that's a good news that jobs have come back, it's not so good that in a historical, they've done fairly weak. And one more point on that is that in the last 5 months, especially private sector employment is only averaging just over 100,000 a month for the past 5 months, and the previous 5 months before that, they averaged about 198,000. So there's been even within the more recent history, if you just look over the last year or so, we see a real slowdown in jobs.
Well, what's happening? Why is employment not growing with the speed that it did in the late 90s?
Well, we think a lot of things are going on. Certainly, part of that has to do with the Feds, that for a very long period of time kept increasing the interest rate, and through tightening, and certainly they paused last time they met, and so that was a good sign, and we hope that they continue to pause, because there's clearly no indication of inflation, wage inflation, and so we hope that they continue to pause so we could have more job growth pick up a little bit more and worker bargaining power. I mean, at the heart of all of this is, or at least a good part of it, is worker bargaining power has eroded. So you have increased globalization, you have your continued erosion of union and union bargaining power, and workers, the business climate now favoring business over, so much more over workers. And so, the bargaining clout is hurt. And again, absent full employment, because that's one of the, as we can see by looking at these data, one of the last friends of the last standing friend of workers is full employment economy. So we would hope that the Feds, who are always very, very concerned, and rightly so with inflation, also put on their agenda a tighter labor market so we can see some real wage gains.
I'm speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and co-author, along with Larry Michel and Jared Bernstein, of The State of Working America, 2006-2007. Well, I just want to talk for a bit, kind of short of time because of the technical delays.
Yeah, again, I apologize. I didn't even know it was happening. I wondered what was going on.
No way to tell you, unless I can't do my astral projections properly. But there's a... Inequality, of course, has been a feature of growing inequality has been a feature of the U.S. economy since about 1973, mm-hmm. And there are many explanations for this. But probably the most popular, and the one that makes its way into the popular press, is it's all about skills, and that the average worker is either too dumb or ill-educated to make it in this economy, and we all need specialized training and advanced degrees. What do you make of that explanation? Is it really, as they say, skills-biased technical change, or is there something else going on?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, first of all, we do have, because now you're getting kind of a long series. We can go back decades, and we're just seeing, over the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, into 2000. So we do have a longer time frame where inequality is growing, and certainly that the erosion of union density and union bargaining power and National Labor Relations Board decisions that seem to favor businesses over workers, especially in that long time frame, have everything to do with what happens to the distribution of economic growth. Certainly, another, you hear this idea that, we can kind of educate our way out of this, that, we just need to, upgrade. But if you look at what has happened, especially in 2000 to 2000, even into 2006, the college wage hasn't gone anywhere either. It isn't just that it's low-wage workers who've had stagnating wages. The college wage has stagnated. So it's not the case that that we can just kind of educate our way out of this. And we also see that the other economic indicators, such as employment rates and unemployment rates, when you look at the last two downturns, people with education didn't do, aren't as protected from economic downturns as they once were. And certainly part of this part of the explanation here is the idea that we do have increased pressures regarding globalization. And even though a lot of jobs right now aren't being shipped out, and we don't have a lot of data on this, but it's not necessarily that you just need to lose your job, but the threat of losing your job and the threat of having very skilled labor force overseas in places like India with the opening of the borders and increased globalization. Also, maybe one of the biggest effects we think is not necessarily on jobs, but on wage suppression.
All right, well, we're going to have to end it there. I'm sorry for the delay and the abbreviation, but I'll bring you back, if it's okay with you, in a few weeks to talk about how the U.S. stacks up internationally, which is
that'd be fantastic.
Something that would make us hang our heads in shame.
Yeah, that's one of my chapters. I'd love to talk about
Okay, so let's do that in a couple of weeks.
Give me a call back. That'd be great.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and the co-author, along with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein, of Their State of Working America. It's out in galley form now, but it will be out as a book from Cornell University Press at the beginning of 2007. And turning to some local perspective on these sorts of issues, we're now joined on the line by Mark Levitan, who is an economist with the Community Service Society and the absolute master of income and poverty statistics in New York City. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to WBAI, Mark Levitan.
Good evening.
So we're a little behind schedule, but I think we can get some good info in here. First of all, let's just talk about the raw numbers here. The poverty rate nationally between 12% and 13%, but here in New York City,
close to 22%.
Tell us who's poor and how poor are they?
Well, of course, the poverty rates vary by race, so that's one thing that people should keep in mind. The citywide poverty rate, 22%. The poverty rate for non-Hispanic whites, 11.5%. The poverty rate for African-Americans, 30%. For Hispanics, 29%.
And we should point out that this uses the national poverty line, which is not adjusted for the higher expense of living in New York City, right?
Right. The poverty threshold in New York City is the same as the poverty threshold in Nevada. So just so listeners know, if we're talking about a family of three people, we're talking about a threshold of a little under $16,000 a year.
So trying to live in New York City on $16,000 a year is really hard. But a lot of people do it, almost a quarter of our population. What's been happening with the poverty rate? We've supposedly been having a great economy. You know, the business cycle has been good in New York City on the face of it. The trends in New York City over the last couple of decades, Wall Street has been thriving, gentrification everywhere. What's the trend been in income and poverty here?
Well, we haven't seen much trickle down. We've had enough of a recovery so that we finally have halted the growth in the poverty rate. But wages are lagging behind the pace of the cost of living in New York City. So poverty isn't declining. And what I think is really troubling is that poverty is rising among working families. When we look at low-income New Yorkers, we see that more families are working full-time year-round. They're working more hours, but earnings are down and poverty is up.
Well, what about the income distribution in the city? How does it compare to the rest of the country?
Well, Manhattan, as you may know, tops the list of counties in the United States that have the most egregious disparities in income. When we look at the city as a whole, we see that as well. I mean, New York is a unique place in the United States in that relative to other cities, we're very rich. We have a high income per person, per capita, but we also have a very high poverty rate. So if we were going to, say, take the 25 largest cities in the United States, we'd see cities with a low poverty rate and a very high per capita income, say, like San Jose, California. And we'd see cities with low per capita incomes and very high poverty rates, like Detroit, Michigan. But New York sort of fits outside that pattern. We have a relatively high per capita income and a very high poverty rate, and that's because we have such a high degree of inequality. We have a lot of income here, but it's not well shared.
Yeah, actually, one of my favorite ways of illustrating that is that we got one of the richest census tracts in the country in the Upper East Side, close to some of the poorest in East Harlem. So they're right, you know, practically next to each other, yet this is the extremes of wealth and poverty in the United States. It's a remarkable conjunction there. But, you know, you walk around town, you see tremendous gentrification everywhere, fancy stores coming in, condos going up everywhere. It looks like the city is prosperous. Who is filling up all these condos and who is buying from all these stores? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, we really do walk around with these two pictures of the city in our heads. And one of them is that the city is a successful place, that we've come back from the recession, we've come back from the terrorist attack on September 11th. We're doing well compared to a lot of other cities, but then the poverty data come out and they're always a slap in the face. They're always a cold shock of reality that there is this enormous population of New Yorkers, this 1.7 million people who are living below this abysmally pitiful threshold. It's outrageous.
What is it structurally about the New York City economy that makes for such widespread and deep poverty?
Well, I think it's a number of things, but I think when we're thinking about why there's growing working poverty, really we've had a hollowing out of the middle tiers of the job distribution. So we have an enormous number of white-collar professional jobs. Almost half the people who work in New York City are executives, managers, professionals, technical workers. But along with that, we have a growing number of people in low-wage service occupations. And in a way, these two things are symbiotic. That is, the professionals create a demand for service work, and that demand feeds the growth of low-wage service jobs.
And is there anything that we can do about this, or is it just beyond the capacity of New York City as a jurisdiction to come up with policies to address these issues?
Well, I think there are things that could be done locally, but clearly when we're talking about something about poverty, this is really a federal issue at the end of the day. One city, even as wealthy as New York, cannot solve this problem on its own. And when we're talking about national policy, of course, there's a lot that can be done. We have more low-wage jobs, but that doesn't mean that people have to suffer low incomes. And we could do a lot more in terms of our tax structure to even out the inequalities that are generated in the labor market.
All right, we'll have to bring it to a close there. Thank you for joining us, Mark Levitan. You've got a report coming out any day now that will be on the Community Service Society website.
Right, www.cssny.org.
Okay, well, thank you. And anybody
thank
who
you.
Wants to read that, check it out. Keep an eye on, and there's much else on the Community Service Society website. Lots of data about the income and poverty in New York City. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I will be back next week. And let's go out with track 6, Michael, because we're skipping a little bit here. Let's go out a little music from the Long Blondes. They're A Knife for the Girls from a 7-track demo. And that's till next week. Goodbye.